Now, for our blind and print-impaired audience, the North Carolina Reading Service brings you... Indie Week, read by John Feddersen. This issue, dated November 18, 2020. Musicians today have asked actually not to be identified on the air. They are calling themselves the Whistleblowers. Their music is being electronically altered to prevent clues to their names and instruments being broadcast. We'll hear from them if they're still around at the end of our hour. And we'll get into our first column news by Tomasi McDonald from Durham, Breaking Barriers. In an election month filled with delayed results, frivolous lawsuits, a recount, and baseless claims of voter fraud, the race for the Durham County Board of Commissioners proved decidedly uncontentious. That's because the outcome was all but sealed in the primary back in March. In deep blue Durham County, North Carolina, the five Democratic candidates on the ballot all ran unopposed in the general election this month. When they're sworn in December, newcomers Nima Sheena Burns and Nida Alam will join incumbents Wendy Jacobs, Heidi Carter, and Brenda Howerton. Their victories mean that Durham County will have an all-female Board of Commissioners for the first time in the commission's 139-year-old history. Voters also made history by electing Alam, who is the first Muslim woman to hold elected office in the state of North Carolina. Alam's political career was born out of tragedy in 2015 when her best friend Yusor Muhammad Abu Salah, age 21, her sister Razan, 19, and Yusor's husband Dia Shadi Baccarat, 23, were shot to death by neighbor Craig Stephen Hicks inside their condo in Chapel Hill. Authorities later claimed they could not find sufficient evidence to prosecute the triple murder as a hate crime, though Hicks had expressed bitter animus toward Muslims in social media posts. Alam recently told Cardinal and Pine, referring to Yusor, "I was a bridesmaid in her wedding in December, and then in February she was gone." Alam, a Triangle native, is the daughter of immigrant parents and a graduate of North Carolina State University. Previously, she worked as a political director for the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign and as an organizing director for Sherry Beasley, the incumbent NC Supreme Court Chief Justice, who is in the throes of a remarkably tight race with conservative challenger Paul Newby. As she began to begin her historic tenure, Alam spoke with the Indy about what brought her to this moment and how she plans to govern. How and why did you get involved in politics, and what made you decide to run for office? Dia, Yusor, and Razan exemplify what it means to be a proud Muslim American, she answers. They lived their entire lives looking to serve not only our Muslim community, but communities across the country and even globally. When they were taken from us in the Chapel Hill shooting, their parents asked all of their friends to not let their legacy die, to continue to remember the three of them and cherish them in our work. It was their parents' strength and love that pushed me to look for ways to defeat the hate that took my friends, to make sure no other family or community would have to live through the pain we endured. It was soon after their passing that the 2016 presidential campaigns were gearing up, and I was drawn to Senator Sanders for the way that he spoke about people that were different from him. He never othered the Muslim community. He never spoke about us with the stereotypes and tropes that we often hear from mainstream news and politicians. He spoke of a message of social justice, economic justice, and racial justice for all human beings, and how all of us can build a movement together. At this point, he was still polling only at 2% nationally, but I knew that campaign and message were vital for our country. I decided to run for office because I had been working behind the scenes in progressive movement and voter mobilization organizations. I saw during that work the need for progressive candidates to step up to carry forward the message of our values and policy. I also saw a need for change in how we discuss politics and how we organize. As a voter and constituent, I have always wanted to see more emphasis from elected officials on engaging with community members while they are in office, just as much as they did while running, because the conversation shouldn't end once you're in office. Question: with your historic election, can you speak to the values you bring to the table and how that might help underrepresented communities? The values that I was raised with as a Muslim, the values that Dia, Yusor, and Razan were raised with, to be proud of where we came from, and to take care of our neighbors and to live in service of others. It is narrated that our Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, said, "None among you is a true believer unless he loves for others what he loves for himself." As a public service, it's my duty and obligation to not take my privileges for granted, and that I must use what I've been blessed with to serve the people around me, and to build for them to have the same opportunities, if not more than I have. Breaking barriers and being the first doesn't stop there. It's about reaching that point and bringing people along with you to break all the barriers so we can have a truly representative government. Did you ever consider moving away from the Triangle? What keeps you here? Durham has long been where I wanted to live. My family moved to North Carolina when I was 5 years old, and I was raised right on the border of Raleigh-Durham in Briar Creek. My parents did everything they could to build a life where my sisters and I would be able to strive and live our own American dreams. We went to magnet schools. We would commute 30 minutes to near downtown Raleigh with predominantly white classmates from elementary to high school. Up until eighth grade, I didn't wear the hijab full-time, and it was very evident when I did begin to wear the hijab how my classmates' perception of me changed instantaneously. It took some time, but I did end up finding a home in a friend group in high school that was very diverse, not just in race, ethnicity, but also in talents and aspirations. As I began to grow in early adulthood and to consider what life I wanted to build for myself and my future family, a prominent aspect would be the experiences I want my kids to have and to protect them from being othered, as I was at such a young age. Durham is where I saw and still see that to be possible. I see a diverse and vibrant community, just like my small, close-knit friend group in high school. Durham was where we accept folks for who they are and welcome them with open arms. While you were campaigning, you said that economic inequality was the most pressing issue facing Durham. You also said local governments can enact bolder policies. How will you address these issues as a commissioner? Two of these policies include raising the wages for Durham Public School classified staff to a minimum of $15 an hour, and enacting more robust property tax assistance programs, which other municipalities in North Carolina have done, with the advice of the University of North Carolina School of Government. We can't have public sector employees in Durham County who are not making a living wage. Most of these individuals are black women. Many are mothers of children. They deserve and need a living wage. We also need to address the evictions crisis and create more affordable housing opportunities. Finally, we must invest deeply in Durham Public Schools and Durham Technical Community College so that our county residents have every opportunity to develop a love of learning while also developing their analytic minds and skill sets that will permit them to find meaningful and well-compensated work. All of these questions of economic justice are also questions of racial justice. You've talked about the significance of gentrification and displacement in the past. How do you plan to address these issues? Again, a robust property tax assistance program is crucial to permit lower-income homeowners to stay in their family homes rather than being pushed out. Many black families have been in their homes in Durham's neighborhoods for generations, and the pressures of gentrification and higher taxes are pushing them out in favor of flippers. The property tax program that passed this year does not go far enough to relieve the burden on these homeowners. This needs to be a huge priority so that folks who want to stay in their homes have every opportunity to do so. The implementation of the affordable housing bond is also going to be important to make sure that it is really creating opportunities for working class residents to stay in the city's central neighborhoods. Fair transit access and fair wages are also elements of this work, so that our residents can get good jobs and can pay their bills. You've said the city needs to collaborate with the unions. Do you think the public and private sectors are receptive to unions, or will unions drive new and even existing employers elsewhere? Durham is a vibrant, beautiful, and diverse city with so much to offer in terms of culture, music, art, food, technology, North Carolina Central, and Duke University. The list of benefits of this place goes on and on. People all over the world want to come and live and work here. Capital will continue to flow toward Durham. I support organized labor. Unions gave us the weekend, the 40-hour work week, and protections against child labor. The fight for $15, the Durham Association of Educators, and the North Carolina Public Service Workers Union, the National Domestic Workers Alliance, are all examples of organized labor groups in Durham that really center social justice concerns. I think that the people of Durham want to both work at and support institutions that are receptive to unions and dignity in the workplace. If a company cannot satisfy those minimal criteria, I believe that the people of Durham would rather not have that company in their community, not for employment or patronage. As a democratically elected representative, it's also my responsibility to make sure my constituents are safe and healthy and that their voices are heard. This means ensuring that residents of Durham County are employed by companies that treat them with dignity and pay a living wage at the very least. I believe the Durham community wants to pursue equity and justice in more direct and impactful ways. But in order to do that, policymakers such as myself must create pathways to guide community members towards. You have voiced support for a property tax relief program that would reduce the financial burden for homeowners with limited resources. You explain that such a program is important to help Durham maintain its identity. What is the Durham identity, and how will maintaining it slow the process of gentrification? Durham has a multifaceted identity. We have individuals who have lived in Durham their whole lives, as well as newer residents, including immigrants, who have chosen to move here for the opportunities and enjoy the welcoming and inclusive culture. I think the key is to build bridges among all Durham residents of all races and to make sure that we center policy that keeps long-term residents in their family homes, substantially slows evictions, and creates opportunities for home ownership for working-class families. We can't define a Durham identity in exclusive terms. We have to be inclusive of all. After the election, some moderate Democrats have argued that progressive demands thwarted a blue wave. What do you make of that? I don't think the moderate Democrats' assertion on this point is well-founded. We saw incredible energy and turnout for some of the most progressive candidates in Congress this year. We saw Georgia flip blue, truly, from the efforts of grassroots organizers of color centering issues of racial justice. Unfortunately, we also saw there are a great number of people in this country who are willing to support a white supremacist in the White House. Democrats won by an average of 80% in Durham in this year's presidential election. Durham voters have been providing a blue wave for a long time, and I want to ride that wave to enact bold policy. In order to win future elections, Democrats have to provide proof of concept for the values we stand for, which necessitates bold action centered on workers' rights and dignity for all. The Durham community has organized around criminal justice reform for a long time, and as a representative for those dedicated community members, it is my responsibility to ensure that criminal justice policies reflect what the community has clearly demanded. I'm hopeful that the Community Safety and Wellness Task Force can identify evidence-based programs to meaningfully address poverty, mental illness, and alienation so that we have less of a need for armed police and a stronger, healthier community for all of Durham. The city and county are still struggling with the impact of the coronavirus. Tax revenues are down and small businesses are struggling. What steps do you think will help Durham recover from the economic devastation wrought by the pandemic? We need to pour resources into Durham Public Schools. Strong schools make strong communities. I'm proud that Durham Public Schools did go virtual for schooling to keep families, educators, and school staff safe from COVID-19. Coming out of the crisis, we have an opportunity to reimagine schooling and really center democratic decision-making, the community schools model, language access, social and emotional learning, and deprioritizing standardized tests. Austerity budgets are not going to help us recover from this pandemic. I think capital improvements for public schools through a bond referendum give us an opportunity to create jobs as well as improve the physical places where our children learn. Next, Sarah Pequeño's column from Chapel Hill today titled, Is This Seat Taken? In a pre-pandemic world, the empty seat would be noticeable. At Chapel Hill Town Council meetings, there would be a hole, a place where a nameplate should go. In a pre-pandemic world, there would be 9 members of the Chapel Hill Town Council, including the mayor, instead of 8. And there were until January, when former council member Rachel Shevitz announced that she and her family were moving to New Zealand. As the Indy reported, after Shevitz's departure, the town's bylaws say someone should be appointed to fulfill her term, which was supposed to end in 2021. The council received applications for the position at the end of March, again, in accordance with the city bylaws. Yet today, more than 10 months after Shevitz announced she was leaving, the seat is still empty. It's the longest the council has ever gone with a vacancy on the council, according to town clerk Sabrina Oliver. In an October 7th meeting, Mayor Pam Heminger addressed the vacancy. She also brought up an idea from the town council retreat last winter. She said in the October meeting, "We're still interested in taking up this matter, but because of COVID, because of the situation, because of the national elections, we wanted to wait until there was a time when we could have members of the public be more involved in this. It's a bigger community conversation, and the council had also expressed their interest in that conversation first about whether we were considering reducing the number of council members from 9 to 7. Changing town council size is uncommon, but so is the large size of Chapel Hill's. Durham City Council has 7, and Raleigh City Council has 8. Similar-sized college towns tend to have smaller councils. Boone, North Carolina, has 6, and Charlottesville, Virginia, 5. 9-person councils are more common in mid-sized cities like Greensboro and Richmond, Virginia. While other larger councils may only have a fraction of at-large members, every member of Chapel Hill's town council is at-large, meaning that all 9 members are speaking for the whole town, rather than a particular ward or district. Councilmember Jess Anderson says of the current meetings, "Often everybody wants to say something so that residents know where we stand on things, or we can explain why we're voting the way we are, or so we can add to the conversation. So our meetings ended up being incredibly long, which is not great for getting people to run for council because it becomes a really onerous job. But it's also not great for the public and for transparency." The town council, formerly called the Board of Aldermen, was expanded in 1975 in a package that included changing the mayoral term to 4 years instead of 2, setting a term limit for the mayor, and giving the mayor voting power. Jerry Cohen, a former council member who studied law at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, says he remembers reasoning that the board should be expanded to ensure diversity. As a current member of the Wake County Board of Elections, he didn't want to take the position on the matter, but he added that the Chapel Hill Council has consistently had a black member and that several students have served on the city council. When Mayor Heminger and the council began looking into the issue, they didn't find much to back the claim that a bigger board means a broader outlook, especially in a town like Chapel Hill, where opinion tends to be pretty homogenous. She says they also failed to find sources that said a bigger council meant more minority council members. For Heminger, Anderson, and other council members, it's important that the community have the chance for a robust conversation once things are a bit more normal, especially since the current configuration of 8 members hasn't led to any issues. Heminger says, one would think we would have a problem if there's an even number, but we haven't. I'm sure we could, but we haven't seen that yet. We've had some split votes, but it's not been 4-4. So for now, that vacant seat will sit empty a little longer. Another electoral article by Michela Tofighi. Months before there were candidates and fundraisers and the omnipresent yard signs, the North Carolina General Assembly decided the outcome of a second congressional district race. A Democrat would win. To comply with the court ruling, the Republican leaders of the legislature agreed that the second congressional district would be their surrendered soldier. Incumbent Republican George Holding knew this when he announced he would not seek re-election. Democrat Deborah Ross knew it when she launched her campaign for the seat in December 2019, and Alan Swain surely knew it when he agreed to take a bullet for the GOP, running as the party's nominee in a race that was inevitably doomed. No matter how many Swain for Congress signs were planted in yards and medians around the Wake County District, he could not defeat his greatest enemy, the newly redrawn map. Swain said in an email to the 9th Street Journal, Holding's announcement certainly shed light on the realization that running in this district would be an uphill battle. The almost final tally, 311,887 for Ross, 172,544 for Swain. Ross, a civil rights lawyer and longtime state lawmaker, nearly doubled her opponent's vote total. Libertarian Jeff Matamu received almost 11,000 votes, not nearly enough to make up the difference. The map got more friendly for Ross because it was reconfigured to solely encompass Wake County, with lots of Democratic voters in Raleigh and Cary. A similar process unfolded in North Carolina's new 6th Congressional District, where voters in Greensboro and Winston-Salem easily elected Democrat Kathy Manning by an almost identical margin to Ross. Like Holding, the District 6 Representative Mark Walker, a Republican, also opted not to run again after redistricting last year. That's politics in the age of gerrymandering. Bob Phillips, Executive Director of Common Cause North Carolina, a nonpartisan group that promotes transparency in government and opposes gerrymandering, says lawmakers can't resist the temptation to help themselves. Those who are in power, currently the GOP, in North Carolina's state legislature, want to ensure they maintain that power, he said. The Republican strategy for the maps is to concentrate Democrats into as few seats as possible, according to Phillips. The doctrine is lose big and win small when you have the power to draw the maps. And so you'll pack as many Democratic voters into as few districts as you can. This played to Ross's advantage. In 2018, Wake County elected U.S. Representative David Price with over 70% of the vote. Ross won by similar margins this election, claiming victory with about 63% of the vote. For Swain, the new map signaled defeat. For Ross, it meant opportunity. After a failed U.S. Senate run against incumbent Richard Burr in 2016, Ross still wanted to represent North Carolina in Washington, but she needed an opening. She told the Ninth Street Journal in an interview, "I wasn't going to run against David Price. But when they redrew the maps, I was in a different congressional district." As a resident of Raleigh, the redrawn maps moved her out of Price's district. "The biggest factor was new seat, no Democrat," she said. Map makers will also make or break Ross's chances for re-election. With 2020 census data, the maps will be reconfigured yet again, with population growth likely adding a 14th seat for North Carolina, and with that comes the temptation for more gerrymandering. By successfully maintaining control of the North Carolina State House and State Senate in this election, Republicans will once again be in the driver's seat. Now, the cover story for this week's Indie Week is a story about the lost era of indie rock. And I'll get back to that, and as much time as I have for other music and art-related things, here's a food and drink article first called Knives Out by Adam Sobzi. When the COVID-19 pandemic struck, insurance brokers warned restaurant clients against trying to file for coverage in the event of a shutdown. Early last month, though, a Superior Court judge ruled that Cincinnati Insurance Company, one of the largest property insurers in the country, was liable for coverage in a lawsuit brought collectively by 16 restaurants. The decision hit home for two reasons. One was that the restaurants are here in the Triangle. They include the Matt Kelly and George Bacatius Portfolio, Mateo Tapas, St. James Seafood, Vin Rouge, and more than a dozen others, who use our resources and make management decisions together on a regular basis, Matt Kelly said, told the Indy. The other reason, among over 1,000 similar suits brought nationwide during the pandemic, this is the first that any plaintiff has won, strictly speaking. It is the first, quote, the first judgment in the country that is non-procedural and finds that coverage should be provided, says Gagan Gupta from the Hillsborough-based Painter Law, the lead attorney in the case. The victory, he adds, quote, will hopefully be precedent for North Carolina and for states around the country. The key to Gupta's successful litigation was his focus not on the virus itself, specific coverage for which insurers might more easily contest, but on Governor Roy Cooper's executive orders that mandated closures. Gupta zeroed in on the policy language inclusion of two terms, damage and loss. If the contractual phrase direct physical damage was reasonably understood as a structural alteration to property, Gupta argued, direct physical loss must mean something different. District 14A Superior Court Judge Orlando Hudson agreed, finding that direct physical loss describes a scenario where business owners and employees, customers, vendors, suppliers, and others lose the full range of rights and advantages of using or accessing their business property. This was precisely the loss caused by the government orders. Ironically, those orders came just weeks after St. James Seafood had finally reopened, following a nearly 10-month closure caused by the deadly Brightleaf Square gas leak explosion in 2019. Kelly was thus no stranger to his insurance policy, but parsing its application to the pandemic was, quote, beyond anything we thought we would ever understand. Bacatius says it was an emotional moment. He was remembering a meeting with his ownership group in March to assess the emergencies. Livelihoods and careers were at stake. Kelly wondered, how are small, independent restaurants going to find the resources and skill set to fight in a situation where we shouldn't have to be fighting at all? As it happened, Gupta and his fiancée, Erica Larson, had planned to hold their wedding reception at Vin Rouge, which is co-owned by Kelly and Bacatius, on Labor Day weekend. With that in doubt, Gupta says, I thought maybe there was a way I could help out. He offered to look over Kelly's policy, as he had done for many small local businesses during the spring, aiming to attract clients for litigation. The Indy reported on his efforts in April. When he looked at Kelly's plan, he says it was clear that the coverage should be provided. Kelly says, Gagan was very articulate and confident. He gave us real hope. That's why I said, let's put some time into it and see if we can get some traction. Gupta says, they took a risk and dedicated quite a bit of their team's resources and effort to that lawsuit. More will be required. Last week, Cincinnati Insurance Company formally appealed Judge Hudson's ruling, citing a letter from North Carolina Insurance Commissioner Mike Causey that reasoned that business interruption insurance had not been designed for a pandemic and that this type of loss could, quote, cripple the insurance industry. Concerningly, the November elections also saw every contested state appellate and Supreme Court flip Republican. Unfavorable reports that, quote, appeared to validate the politically motivated decision of Republican lawmakers in recent years to change all judicial races from nonpartisan to partisan, according to NC Policy Watch. The close race between incumbent Democratic Supreme Court Justice Sherry Beasley and Republican challenger Paul Newby remains undecided as of Tuesday's printing, with Beasley calling for a recount. Gupta acknowledges, we're definitely pushing a boulder up a hill. He's ready for a potentially protracted legal battle. Meanwhile, there are more immediate concerns, like the weather. Kelly worries, winter is coming. Outdoor seating is what gets people to our places right now. A month or so ago, a big cold front moved in for a couple weeks. It gave us a real dose of reality. Picatius is older and more philosophical still. He admits, I could paint a rosy picture, but it wouldn't be true. People are closing while we're having this conversation. People are selling things off so they can get by. Their restaurants never stopped paying full-time salaries to managers and chefs. We needed them to be on the front lines for us, Picatius said, even after federal paycheck protection program funds ran out. Kelly, still recovering from losses resulting from St. James Seafood's long closure, I'm looking at bankruptcy. The money we're losing is not imaginary money. To-go business has only slowed, not stopped, the bleeding. Ditto Durham's autumn weekend streetery, which feels festive but isn't sustaining or sustainable. It ends in mid-December, and indoor dining rooms are still limited to half capacity. The executive orders, however necessary, continue to cause losses. Just because restaurants are open doesn't mean they're making money. Appetizing local Instagram feeds that tag the likes of the streetery project the high life and spirits of the hospitality business. But Kelly says, we're not in the realm of hospitality right now. Instead, they ventured into the murkier realm of the law, where they're fighting not only for themselves but on behalf of all restaurants. It might not be a stretch to say they're fighting for all of us who dine in them, too. Now we will visit at least a portion of Brian Howe's cover story about the lost era of indie rock music. In the saga of local music, the turn of the millennium was not a major stanza. It was a transitional, nebulous time. The national attention lavished on Chapel Hill indie rock in the 90s from mainstream breakouts like Squirrel Nut Zippers and Ben Folds 5 to underground legends like Superchunk and Archers of Loaf had fizzled. Napster had started to trouble the music industry, but the Internet had yet to develop the commercial and documentary infrastructure we know today. As a result, many of the most popular local bands of the late 1990s and early 2000s are all but forgotten. They seem adrift in time and culture, marooned on some vague island between the well-mapped continents of Gen X and the Millennials. Gen Y2K, if you will, scantily documented by the major press and predating MySpace, it left little to no trace online, though there's some good indie coverage, shout out to Angie Carlson, If you can find it after 20 years of metadata shredding website migrations, if the golden age of science fiction, as the famed quip has it, is 12, then the golden age of indie rock is 21. I happen to be a vague citizen of Generation Y2K. I plunged into the Chapel Hill Carborough indie scene in the year 2000 for a simple reason. I turned old enough to drink in the smoky nightclubs where it lived. To reconstruct that time through 20 local albums that turned 20 years old in 2020, I aided my Miller High Life clouded memory by digging up my earliest writings from a zine called Sup and a vanquished indie competitor called The Spectator, which I diligently clipped at the start of what turned out to be my career. I also bugged musicians to hear some albums I, and maybe they, hadn't heard in years, and I consulted some local music journo pals, Trucker Hat Tipped David Menconi and Grayson Haver Curran. I exercised some personal prerogatives. I allowed albums that came out in 1999 or 2001, but with a mind toward restoring the record, I omitted eligible groups that made their primary impact in the 90s or as long legacies. Hence, you'll find none of the aforementioned indie rock big shots or Corrosion of Conformity or Jenny Any Kind or the Connells or Southern Culture on the Skids or any number of other heartless exclusions. And I decided against trying to shoehorn in the few surviving local records that aren't in some way under the indie rock umbrella. It's depressing to look back on how white and heteronormative my horizons were then, but it's also heartening to realize how different this list would look if it were about 2010, let alone 2020. But I'm not including Shaw University-bred hip-hop group Lords of the Underground, or Justice League's Caesar Comanche, both of whose impact came a bit too early. I'm also going to skip MC Paul Barman, even though his 2000 EP, It's Very Stimulating, was produced by Prince Paul and had the dubious distinction of setting the nerd rap mold. So, come with me to Y2K, a slice of recorded time lost somewhere between stories. As notable for what it lacked as for what it had, it still produced bands that meant the world to the young adults whose lives they scored. Its musicians still seed today's terrain, and its best moments stand the test of time. Now, Mr. Howe in this article now gives his 20 albums and artists and a paragraph or two about each one of these releases. And I'm going to eliminate most of that data. I will include the artists and the title of the album and the band members when this was released. And if you need more information about these, you can visit Independent Indie Week, and here see this cover story. And he begins with 2000, with Caitlin Carey and the album Waltzy. And that's with members Caitlin Carey and Mike Daly and others. Then we have Cold Sides, a record of the same name. And that was Moment Before Impact Records at 2001. Robert Biggers, Zeke Graves, David Nauman, Eric Cope. The Comas, A Deaf Needle in Tomorrow on Yep Rock Records at 2000. Members Andy Harrod, Nicole Gehweiler, Margaret White, and John Harrison. Fin Fang Foom, album Texture, Structure, and the Condition of Moods, You Love It Records, 2001. And those members, Eddie Sanchez, Mike Triplett, and Mike Glass. We have Idyll Swords, album just titled Two. That's on the Communion label. Dave Berlofsky, Grant Tenniel, and Chuck Johnson came out in 2000. The Kingsbury Manx, an album of the same name from Overcoat Records, 2000. Ryan Richardson, Scott Myers, Bill Taylor, and Kenneth Stevenson. Malt Swagger's release, The Lost Pilot, came out in 2000. Members, Steve Carter, Mark Cunningham, Dave Jernigan, Meredith Jones, Andy McGowan, and Roland Otwell. And we have the Mayflies USA album, The Pity List, from Yep Rock 2000. Members, Matt McMichaels, Adam O'Fallon Price, Matt Long, and David Lizigang. We have Mile Marker, album Frigid Forms Cell, released in 2000 from Lovett. Members Al Burian, Dave Laney, Roby Newton, Ben Davis, and Sean Husick. Kenny Roby, Ricebox Records release of 2000, Mercury Blues. That featured Kenny Roby, Steve Grothman, Ray Duffy, Rob Ferris, Dave Wright, Rich Avery, Caitlin Carey, and Scott Miller. Sankofa's album, self-released in 1999, Five Elements, featuring Stephen Greenlee, Mark Wells, Matt Brandau, DJ Pez, and Apple Juice Kid. Moving on to releases in 2000 and 2001, self-released Shallow Be Thy Name, and that was a duo, Clark Blomquist and Carolyn Johnson. We have from Shark Quest, Man on Stilts album from Merge Records in 2000. Chris Eubank, Chuck Dick Johnson, Groves Willer, Kevin Dixon, Laird Dixon, Ben Felton, Sarah Bell, and Scott Goolsby. Sorry About Dresden album, The Mayor Will Abdicate, from Route 14 Records, came out in 1999. Members Eric Rorick, Matt Oberst, Matt Tomich, and James Hepler. Starpoint Electric released Bad Directions from Plastique in 1999. Ted Boyer, Clay Boyer, Steve Galloway, and Cameron Weeks. Strunken White, Lightning and Dark Lighting a Dark North, from Route 14 Records, again 2000. Members Nagendra Jayanti, Noah Howard, John Booker, Jonathan Stickley. And Bloodshot Records, 1999, Trailer Brides album, Wine de Lune. Melissa Swingle, Scott Goolsby, Daryl White, and Brad Goolsby. Transportation released Transportation Extended Play from Demon Beach Records in 2001. Ben Dunlop, Stephen Murtaugh, and Robert Scruggs. We have Deep Elm Records release of 2000 from the White Octave, Style number 6312. Stephen Peterson, Lincoln Hancock, and Robert Biggers. Self-released album from Work Clothes, their extended play called Work Clothes, member Jenny Waters and Lee Waters. And that's the article from, again, from Mr. Howe. And that included many, much more detail about each album, including a recommended track. But we have too much material to cover to continue with that full article. Sorry. Now, a little article called Five Words With. And this, written by Dan Rucha, again, is from Music. And it features Chris Padishall, the pianist and Durham native. Pianist. Chris Padishall's debut as a bandleader at Duke Performances was originally envisioned as a sweeping affair. A Durham native and rising figure in the New York jazz scene would spend a year-long residency giving performances and collaborating with students from Duke University and Jordan High School, which he attended. When the pandemic made in-person performances impossible, Duke Performances shifted its season online, commissioning high-quality films from artists who normally would have performed in person. He took this as an opportunity to create a film that draws upon his many musical and extra-musical inspirations, with visual elements shot by Nick Hughes that are suffused with close shots and dynamic moods. The program includes selections from Mary Lou Williams' Zodiac Suite, a movement of William Dawson's Negro Folk Symphony, and an assortment of songs with South African singer Vuyo Sotashe that push well beyond the standards. Ahead of the performance, which premieres this Saturday, the penultimate show of Duke Performance's fall season, Padishall discusses the themes of the performance. And here are the headings and his comments about all of them. Mary Lou Williams. He says, there's a photograph of her imprinted into my mind. She's leaning back against an upright piano in a white dress. There's a bird cage next to the piano. There's something so strong and defiant and resilient in her expression. Mary Lou, for me, is a constant guiding light. I'm not a particularly superstitious person, but she feels like someone whose presence has been around me for a long time. I see playing part of her Zodiac Suite as an effort to raise awareness of her brilliance as a performer and composer. A lot of times people mention almost her like a side note, saying, oh yeah, she was a composer, she also was an educator. I used to think that was dismissive, a short pause before moving on to Coleman Hawkins or whatever. But the thing is, there's a profound understatement in a sentence like that because she was an incredible performer and educator. She was so committed to community and developing talent and supporting people around her. She did that all through her life before she got to Duke. And she did it at Duke, too. Next, Vuyo Sotashe. I first met Vuyo probably like in 2013. He was getting his master's at William Patterson University on a Fulbright. I had also gone there, and David Dempsey, the head of the program, very enthusiastically said, you've got to hear this guy sing. Vuyo has one of the most perfect instruments I've ever heard. His voice is incredible. His technique is unbelievable. He's in control of the instrument and is just beautiful and resonant. His phrasing and his imagination are incredible. Now here's a different one. Jorge Luis Borges. He's kind of the archetype for me. The combination of the most meticulous detail and brilliant use of language to evoke metaphor, allusion, historical reference. His command of the language allowed him to create such a dense web in such a brief amount of space. And to contrast that with those unbelievably imaginative ways of rendering the universe, of thinking about time, space, and self, and how we know ourselves, really grappling with so much information and doing it with this dry humor and this sardonic, quirky wit. I am always aiming for something like that. About film. I spent a lot of time this year, in particularly, studying Bernard Herrmann and Jerry Goldsmith. That was one of my COVID projects, transcribing cues of theirs and stuff. I had done a handful of live streaming things at the beginning of COVID, and I knew that at least in March, April, and May, so many of them were so pathetic in terms of production value. If I'm going to do this, I want the things that I've gathered from all the films I've watched and all the books I've read and all my other interests to really feed into this, and not just have a flat document with a compelling performance, but also a compelling document where, hypothetically, you could mute the volume and hopefully still be compelled to watch, you know? And the final paragraph, recontextualizing standards. We start the film with I'll Never Be the Same. I was listening to this incredible recording of Art Tatum called In Private, which has this incredible version of that song where he feels especially free and improvisational. I used to play it in all these kinds of cute fashions. I went and listened to Billie Holiday with Teddy Wilson, and I was on the edge of tears. I don't know if it's a dark joke, but I think I'll Never Be the Same is the thing that all of us can say in 2020 at this point. Everybody is dealing with a completely new reality. It's not really a song about love lost anymore. It's a song about the stages of grieving that we've all had to go through. The emotional pinnacle of the whole show for me is They Say I Look Like God by Dave and Iola Brubeck, sung by Louis Armstrong. I think the piece speaks to this summer and everything that we watched happen with George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. All of its potency is delivered in the form of a question. There's something about that that's very powerful, because I think if you try to shout somebody down and tell them they're wrong, you're probably going to encounter some resistance. There's something about the Socratic method of just asking a question in such a way that you reveal the cruelty in the question. Now, a theatrical stage article that we don't see that often or have time to read in the Indie Week, this by Brian Woods from the North Carolina State University's Theater, Argo, The Voyage of Jason and the Argonauts. Somewhere in the production process for Argo, a multimedia take on the epic Greek poem, the Argonautica, by NC State's University Theater, visual artist Darby Madewell realized just how meta the unlikely project had become. Reflecting on how the story's adventurous central character, Jason, is no longer the same person by the end of his journey, Madewell says, "That was true of everyone who touched this project. It was so much out of everyone's comfort zone. We were like our own little band of Argonauts, developing as we went." On one level, theater is always close-knit. Somewhere, even in a pandemic, a small troupe of stage artists is always taking on the world. When putting on a production, a company will invariably encounter a host of unexpected wrinkles that threaten their endeavor before coming up with one more move to save the show. By nearly any measure, director Rachel Clem's current retelling of the ancient Hellenic myth, which is available now on YouTube, is itself a tale of dramatic roadblocks and extreme artistic countermeasures in response. Putting Jason's epic expeditions on stage was never going to be easy. Broadway playwright and director Mary Zimmerman's version, the follow-up to her Tony Award-winning Metamorphoses, which local audiences saw at Playmakers Repertoire, runs nearly 3 hours. When Clem initially selected that work for NC State's main stage season this year, its intense set design and costuming demands were set to pose a challenge as great as last year's titanic production of Ragtime. Clem says, "I wanted to work with scenic designer Jamie Melema on something spectacular like we did on Around the World in 80 Days. Then the coronavirus hit. First the university's spring productions and then its popular summer theater fest and 2021 season were all scrapped. In their wake, a theater program no longer able to produce live theater had to come up with other ways to teach and pursue its art form." Clem tapped local playwright, podcaster, and audio drama producer Tamara Kassain to collaborate on a new hour-long audio adaptation of the Argonautica. And Clem says, "It was like this big stone plinth that we just kept chopping away at until we found the shape of what it was." Over marathon recording sessions, audio engineer Kevin Wright could only record 2 actors at a time due to social distancing restrictions. Wright says, "We wound up with hundreds of little audio clips. Editing them was like stacking matches." But when Clem approached Melema and costume designer and creative director Laura Parker for storyboards for a visual component for the project, she learned her concept was still too large to execute. She says, "Then I thought, what if we just sort of crowdsourced the idea, get a bunch of visual artists to storyboard it, so that lots of people were working on the thing and not just two." When a call went out to present, and former theater students, over 20 responded, including artists from England and India. That outpouring of creative contribution, in turn, posed a new problem for the evolving project. Normally, 7 to 8 people convene to manage a show's production elements. Parker says, "On this project, Production manager David Jensen and I were liaisoning each week with 20 to 22 student artists. It was a massive organizational challenge. But as the cohort of visual artists were granted license to pursue their individual visions of the places Jason traveled, Argo turned into a prismatic collection of takes on an ancient text. Parker observes, each new scene is a different world and a different visual experience. As we pass from scene to scene, we see new things through different lenses and different perspectives. After artists Sun Gupta and Louis Bailey bring anime influences to A Song of the Argonauts, Lydia Wonderly and Ariel Penland maneuver paper puppets against the pages of an old-fashioned pop-up book. Line drawings animate the evocative black-and-white photos in one of Darby Madewell's sequences before Kenise Granson Holloway's innovative animations are projected onto the sails of a 3D model of a ship. Nicole Jimenez's rough, zine-influenced ink drawings evoke an edgy graphic novel. Reagan Santillan's detailed pen and ink work, meanwhile, probes the internal conflicts that plague cunning King Aetes and his enigmatic daughter Medea. In a later Granson Holloway sequence, projected colored oils and waters in motion on a glass dish evoke the psychedelic liquid light shows of the 1960s. Clem says they all kept putting me in check. I'm like, wait a minute, this is really mature work coming out of these young people. For the director, Argo ultimately echoes the present moment. Clem says we use epic stories to try to find ourselves in our own journey. We're all in this period where we don't know what to expect from day to day, and we don't know where we're going. We're in the middle of a trial. We have to face our battles as they come without knowing what the end result is going to be and heal the people who need to be healed. We're the Argonauts. And now this edition of the Indie Week Epic must close. But you can relive it in all its audio splendor by visiting the podcast section of our website. And that's ncreadingservice.org. And our musicians, the mysterious whistleblowers, have apparently donned their winter camouflage, all white with fur collars, and they are playing us off the air. And for the North Carolina Reading Service, John Federson says, until next week's Indie Week, so long.